Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 41, Year of the Super Ladies.
This will be one of our regular TV talk episodes. But instead of what we've done the last few times, with a very general, broad overview, touch on everything briefly shows, this time we're taking a little bit more of a focus, a thesis, if you will, talking about the prominently featured female super characters.
You know, to keep the episode to a reasonable length, and to be all hip and 21st century and all.
I mean, I got this idea because of all of these stupid articles that were talking about who would win, Jessica Jones or Supergirl?
And you said iZombie would.
But everyone was like, oh, because Jessica Jones, Supergirl is not going to be, or because people like Supergirl, what does it mean about Jessica? They're very different shows. They are not even both television shows. They aren't competing for ratings or time slots.
But they do both feature estrogen Americans.
Ah, see?
So
see?
And they have that in common, so yeah. They have to go in the same box. Don't you understand anything?
Demographics.
Well, let's table that conversation for a little while, because we have some feedback.
We have a lot of feedback.
We got good response from our last couple of episodes about Christmas music and our new geek resolutions. Episode 39 was the Christmas music episode, and Tom Panarese from the excellent Pop Culture Affidavit site wrote in to say Professor Allen and Emily wanted to write in and say how much I enjoyed your Christmas songs episode. It definitely delivered on its promise to give us some obscure music, because Tom is not Chris Ouellette. I didn't recognize any of the artists you played. And here I thought I was the one specializing in the random and obscure.
Well, we're all podcasters. So we're all about niches.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like
there are niches within niches within niches that only a few of us tread.
On the internet, the term obscure means a slightly different thing than it does out in, you know, reality.
The episode, of course, was heavy with religious tunes, which I found an interesting break from the type of stuff that I included in my own episode. But the weird thing about me is that even though my current religious status can best be described as lapsed, I still enjoy traditional Christmas hymns and other religious Christmas songs. And since I was raised in New York and had a very Catholic grandmother, I can even appreciate songs about saints. Seriously, though, I think it's the music itself that I love. Angels We Have Heard on High has that long Gloria that I have enjoyed hearing ever since I was a kid. Anyway, I may look into downloading some of these when I get the chance. The Bruce Cockburn song reminded me of early 1980s Springsteen and could have fit right in with some of the slower songs on The River or on Nebraska.
That's a very astute observation.
I thought that was right on target, yes. I also love a good traditional Celtic song. My grandmother came from Newfoundland, and there's an enormous Celtic influence on traditional Newfie music. So thanks again for a great listen, and I hope that both of you have a very Merry Christmas and a safe, healthy, and happy New Year. Thank you, Tom.
Our next email is from Mark Adams of Northern Ireland and the Mark's Mess podcast, which he hosts with Catherine and Charlotte.
Charlotte and Catherine.
Catherine and Charlotte.
Charlotte and Catherine!
Anyway. His email reads, Dear DJ Emily and DJ Professor. I love how everyone just thinks your first name is Professor.
It's not.
I always intend to write and give glowing praise to you for various offerings of podcastery that I enjoy. But then something shiny catches my interest and I move on to something else. So I know you will appreciate the praise I now shower you with. While I enjoy all your episodes, this one caught my ear. It kept me company at work this morning, and it was so good I started to listen to it again when I was wrapping Mrs. Mark's Mess presents this evening. I like a good Christmas song, I do, especially the ones that mean more than, oh look, here's a bit of snow. So I usually end up making a CD mix every year for the car with songs I've found during the year. Next year, I might just use this podcast. A fantastic selection of tunes that speak to my faith as much as anything. I did notice a lot of Celtic songs, or as we like to call them, songs. Okay, not really, but it did amuse me when you mentioned Joanna Hogg, who's down the road. Of course she is. I forget how much good music we have here on our doorstep and how well it travels. So well done on another brilliant episode and for opening me up to more good music. Much appreciated, and happy Christmas.
Thank you, Mark. because all of those songs were related to the faith aspect of Christmas, we did consider making it a Dorkness to Light episode. But we already had a Hanukkah episode up over there.
Yeah,
So it just ended up here.
Yeah.
And everyone likes music. And we have a lot more listeners over here.
That is true. I used my editorial mandate that I would like to point out I use pretty infrequently. It was originally a Dorkness episode, but got bumped by the Hanukkah episode there. And that would have been two episodes in 2 months on Dorkness and none on
Short Box, so here we are. Though, we have already done some plotting and planning for next year's Christmas music episode.
It's going to be weirder.
It's a lot lighter, a lot weirder, and just more on the fun, I think, side.
So this one's for you, Chris Ouellette.
Next year! Next year's for everybody else. Episode 40 featured our Geek Year resolutions and our great buddies, the Sutherlands from Warlord Worlds and Trekker Talk, wrote in. It's actually a combo of a couple of the emails that they sent in. Hi, Professor Allen and Emily. Ruth and I had a fun time listening to your latest episode this morning while getting ready for work. First, we loved hearing the amazing Richard Horvitz's voice during the intro. We have had the opportunity to meet Richard Horvitz a couple of times at conventions.
Of course they have.
We loved hearing about your geeky Christmas presents. So happy to hear that you liked the Green Arrow signed print. As Emily said, you need a Green Arrow to complete your Mike-Girl trifecta. Meanwhile, I heard from the episode that Emily is missing seasons 1, 3, and 5 of Leverage. How can this be? Consider that resolved, because Santa obviously was distracted and missed delivering your package. I'm sure it's on its way now. Whew! Now I feel our gift-giving to the Middletons is in full balance.
Okay, we have awesome people who listen to us. You guys are amaze. Yes.
Darren went on to talk about a comment that I made about being an introvert. Unfortunately, most people confuse being an introvert with being shy, which is not the case, because neither Ruth nor I are shy. I was a radio DJ long ago.
Huh.
So was I. So was our buddy Bob Fisher. So is Scott Rifen.
Huh.
About that.
Internet radio.
What a concept. And Darren says he can get up and give a presentation in front of a group of people with no problem, so definitely not shy, but small talk and a dinner party with people I hardly know, that is grueling for me. And me. And Emily, I think.
At times, yeah.
However, should the opportunity present itself for us to meet up at a con, I know that Ruth and I would genuinely enjoy having the opportunity for small talk with the two of you.
Aww.
So we'll be hoping that maybe we'll all end up at the same event this year. Baltimore Comic Con would have been perfect! We've attended it the last 2 years, but we were very disappointed to see it's been moved to Labor Day this year, because we always go to Dragon Con, which is always on Labor Day, and we've already bought our tickets, so we're struggling to figure out what we're going to do.
Well, whatever the opportunity is, that if we have a chance to meet, I think it's pretty safe to say that we're going to owe Ruth and Darren a meal or...
two.
Three. We might just, move in for the weekend.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and brunch the next day. I enthusiastically recommend that Emily follow through on her plan to listen to the Chimes of Midnight. I am so appreciative of Big Finish for giving the Eighth Doctor a chance to shine, and his adventures with Charlie Pollard and Lucy Miller are absolute favorites of ours. Big Finish does a great job on all of their audios. Also, loved hearing your discussion about Babylon 5, which is another favorite of ours. Great storytelling. Ruth and I had an unprayed answer, a phrase we use to refer to prayers that are answered that we never even thought to pray about, in 1998, when we moved to Southern California for work. One of the first weekends we lived there, there was a Babylon 5 convention that we happened to see an ad for in the paper and were able to attend the event and meet the entire cast.
Of course they have!
Well, that's about it. Take care, Darren. By the way, in a feedback conversation that I had with Darren that ended up on the Quarterbin podcast, it's also been revealed that they've met a James Bond.
Because, of course, they've met James Bond.
I want their life.
I
want their lives.
Live the dream, guys. Live the dream. Bradley Null said that he greatly enjoyed our holiday episode. It's great to see what geek families do for the holidays. Thanks for a great show.
Derek Coward, of the Comic Book Noise family of podcasts, wrote in, I had to stop the latest episode of Shortbox Showcase when Emily said, Get out of my surgery, Mr. Fate, because I'm at work, and laughing raucously would be a distraction.
So would an untrained doctor in a serious life-threatening surgery situation. Just saying, shiny helmet does not a doctorate make.
You are picky with your credentials and skills and abilities that you require of medical professionals.
To be fair, Mr. Freeze apparently does have a medical degree. So I'm going to say that the entire DC universe is suspect when it comes to accreditations.
Maybe that process is not quite as thorough as we'd hope it would be.
We heard from a new listener, Ben Gilmore, or as he apparently is known by, Ben Grimoire. Nice. Hello, I'm a new listener, and I'm really enjoying the network as a whole, but especially the Shortbox Showcase. Listening to people talk about topics they're passionate about is one of my favorite pastimes, and since comics and pop culture are things I like, this podcast was right up my alley. As such, I'd like to touch on a couple of the past episodes to give my hopefully brief opinion on a few episodes in no particular order. Similar to Emily, my introduction to the DC Universe was Justice League, JLU, Teen Titans, and the various other animated TV shows. My sister was the one who really got into Batman Beyond, though. I was more of a Static Shock, Justice League kind of kid. Or as I say, why not all of them?
But I think we can get within a couple of years of Ben's age.
Yeah.
Based on, you can usually do that based on what TV shows or cartoons or book series.
Was the gateway drug.
Exactly.
He continues, I had bought a couple of Convergence titles about a day before I listened to your episode. Based on your descriptions, I've decided to also check out Nightwing and Oracle and Justice League of America, as well as the ones I'd already purchased, Justice League and Aquaman. Yeah, I know the hook-handed Aquaman might not be the best version out there, but that run from the 90s was the first comic I ever read, and holds a special place in my heart.
Now you had something to say about hook-handed Aquaman.
Okay. Aquaman is cool. Pirates are cool. You have Aquaman with a pirate hook. His awesomeness can only increase.
It's like a multiplying effect. It's like squared.
It's exponential. He then weighs in on Identity Crisis. In regards to that, I think my main problem isn't the fact that they had Dr. Light rape Sue, or even that they didn't focus on the rape itself. It's that it was during a retcon, so that Sue was already dead. This destroyed any possibility of seeing any stories focused on her recovery, how it affected her marriage with Ralph, etc. Usually, traumatic events are used to further the character that it happened to, but in this case, we get no chances to see Sue Dibny coping. Because there is no point in comics that you could pick up an issue of anything with Elongated Man and say, oh, this is after the rape. That's really my main issue with the series as a whole, other than the few problems you mentioned in the episode.
I thought that was an interesting take. I think that is probably the most legitimate of the criticisms, or the ones that I can see most clearly.
Agreed. That is the this I think is the problem that people actually have when they say the rape is a problem, or it took her agency, or any of those criticisms that we kind of dismantled. I think what they actually mean is this, that we didn't get to see any of the coping or the relationship and how this
the PTSD
affected, yeah, and how it affected Sue and Ralph together as a couple. I would actually have been pretty interested if they had released a follow-up one-shot of a little bit of that personal side. I think that would be an interesting story. And it is kind of unfair that we don't get to see that.
And one thing that we were thinking about kicking around was that, you know, as a couple, you know, their own coping, both Ralph separately, Sue separately, and them as a couple, well, they don't have their friends, the Lorings, the Palmers, anymore to hang out with. But they do have the Stranges. And maybe the two of them could catch a Zeta beam and maybe spend a little quiet time, a little quality time, a little recovery time on Ran. I think that could have been an interesting, to see them cope, to see to see the men talking about it, to see the women talking about it, to see the couples just trying to, you know, put together their relationships, put together their emotions,
mm-hmm. their own together personal back after feelings. This.
Really, I think Ben, I think that's a great point that Ben makes there.
So I think what we're saying is that's our headcanon, and I am going to have to go write the fanfic.
Oh, my Lance.
It's just going on the list, the eternally increasing list.
Which is what Ben mentions next.
I think my favorite episode so far is the one about superhero prose. I myself would really like to write original superhero fiction and have an idea or two and a few introductory chapters I'd like to work on. And yeah, I agree with you two on fanfiction. Everyone has thought of some fanfiction, even if you didn't write it down. As a side note, I think it's really interesting how most popular comics these days are essentially official fanfiction. Almost none of it is written by its original creator. The only difference between Geoff Johns' Justice League fanfic and mine are that his are published and mine aren't. Well, that and the quality. He closes by saying, Relatively Geeky is a great network with great podcasts, and I look forward to listening more in the future.
Thanks, Ben. It is always great to have new listeners.
And it's always great when new listeners send in emails about old episodes. I've heard this occasionally on other podcasts. People feel kind of guilty writing in about old
episodes. We highly encourage it.
And because of the structure of our show, you know, the fact that there isn't a structure, mm-hmm. it's not like it's a, you know, a sequential series where you're writing in about an issue
right.
that's now 10 months out of date.
Remember what happened 35 issues ago.
Or right. giving your guess on what might happen to the issue
right.
when 6 episodes later down the line it's revealed and there could be some weird wibbly-wobbly timey-wimey-ness.
But we've done separate topics, discrete areas of conversation that we can go back and revisit, like Identity Crisis.
Or Superhero Prose, and mm-hmm. we like going back to those.
Yes. Noel Thingvall from the Masters of Carpentry podcast wrote in, Funnily enough, I just picked up the entirety of Babylon 5 during a sale and looking forward to giving it a full watch. I'm surprised, given how long I've been following JMS, that there's so little of his work I've actually seen. My own geeky resolutions are currently on hold while awaiting a move and a new job, but I've piles and piles of novels lying around and would like to start digging into them more voraciously. Also, having freshly reread Sandman to follow along with a podcast by some friends, A Return to the Dreaming, if you'll pardon the plug.
Oh, please do.
I'm just started working through all the various spinoffs by both Gaiman and others. We'll see how long I make it in that very, very long haul. Yes, always appreciate podcast recommendations. No problem there. In regards to accomplishments, Noel says, 2015 was the year I finally read the entirety of ROM.
Woo!
As well as finished all of Chris Claremont's initial 16-year run on Uncanny X-Men.
Whew.
Both were amazing. I also had a role in Linkara's Atop the Fourth Wall movie, which was a blast.
It just sounds like that was a blast. I follow Linkara on Tumblr. Of course I do. And just seeing some of the behind-the-scenes shots and little bits and pieces of clips, it looked like everyone had a really great time putting that together.
Great.
Iowa's Joe Crawford said that his family decided to skip Christmas for the grown-ups this year, instead focusing on the kids. I did receive a couple of gift cards, which I turned into books, and a wonderful set of signed Star Slayer trades from Ruth and Darren Sutherland.
Of course.
Luckily, my birthday is shortly after Christmas, so I received 2 Doctor Who novels, an Assassin's Creed novel, and Archie Digest. My only real geeky resolutions are these. 1. Read 1 novel and 2 manga or comic trades per week. 2. Finish reading the last remaining box of comics mm-hmm. that have built up. Yeah. And 3, organize the books.
Those all seem reasonable and would be productive.
And difficult, so exactly. Good luck.
Good luck, Joe. No pressure, but you've only got about 11 months left.
Lastly, Happy New Year's, you guys. Thanks for the show, and I look forward to what the new year holds for the professor and Emily.
Ah, thank you, Joe. Stephen J. Rogers reported to us his resolution, be a better feedbacker to podcasts. And commit more to internet projects. Those both seem reasonable.
Clinton Robeson of Coffee and Comics blog commented about our writing resolutions. just listened to the latest Short Box Showcase, and I must say, I think the world needs the Catholic vampire story, sir. It has now become part of the zeitgeist, so now you must see it to completion.
No!
I also look forward to reading Emily's Constantine fanfiction. It sounds incredible.
You see what you did? You were just talking about your own unfinished writing projects, and I was nodding along and encouraging. Then you throw me under the NaNoWriMo unfinished novel bus. And then you backed over me.
and left you for the wolves of the internet to hold you accountable.
Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Clinton. Appreciate that. All right, well, it's time for us to take a break. And when we get back, it's time for some super female TV talk.
Generation Star Wars is speaking up and sharing its story.
I'm Andrew Leyland.
I'm David Michelinie.
I'm Tom Paneris.
I'm Steve Glosson.
I'm Matt Hunsworth.
I'm Scott Gardner.
I'm Ryan Shaw.
I'm Paul Herman.
I'm Jimmy Mack.
I'm Ryder Waldron.
I'm Justin Bulger.
I'm Joseph Tavano.
I'm John Jackson Miller.
I'm Consetta Parker.
I'm Steve Sansweet.
And this.
And this.
And this.
Is my Star Wars story.
Is my Star Wars story.
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 My Star Wars story. Monthly at mystarwarsstory.com and available in the iTunes store.
And we're back.
So we decided a few weeks ago that we were going to do another one of these TV talk episodes since we are now at the mid-season of season two in a lot of shows. Mm-hmm. And so since everything was on break, this was sort of a good time to slot in an episode. And when we were talking about the things that we were really excited about, the new shows, the new characters, we realized that pretty much all of them were female.
Mm-hmm.
There was Supergirl, Jessica Jones, and even on Flash and Arrow, some of the big new characters that we wanted to talk about were females.
Half of Legends of Tomorrow or so.
Approximately. So, I wanted to take this time and sort of talk about that awesome trend that has been coming this year.
Now, as with any time we talk about TV, we are full spoilers. And we are going to be talking about shows up through the midwinter break.
And one...
with maybe an exception or two.
one or two important things have happened now that we are...
But for the most part, full spoilers through about the end of 2015.
Yes.
It's about where we're at.
And let's start off with the great breakout female-led noir crime drama, Jessica Jones.
Oh, I thought it was Night Nurse Season 2.
Oh, yes. Claire Temple is done with this bull, followed by Claire Temple can't even fix your stupid skin, Luke. Please stop showing up broken and bleeding on her front door.
Yeah, that's the one. What did you think of Jessica Jones?
I really liked it. I just want to point this out. For people who thought that Daredevil was too hard to watch, too gruesome, and too bloody, they did not watch episode 10 of Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
Because after I watched that episode, I had to sit down and take about a three-week break.
That was 1,000 cuts?
Yeah. And there were.
Yes.
And about 4 deaths.
Yeah.
That was a tough episode and a tough show to watch.
But generally speaking, it was tough in different ways from Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was the blood, but there was a lot of other thematic things and things that you saw that made it rough and tumble and adult its own way.
Very psychological.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really liked that. And a thing about it that everyone likes to talk about, and since it's relevant to our topic, most of the cast is female. Jessica, her mm-hmm. best friend, her lawyer, the lawyer's girlfriend and ex. So there is a big focus on female voices in that show. And a great thing is that none of those characters sound too similar to one another, that they mm-hmm. all have distinct voices. They are all more than their stereotype or their archetype.
Did you include the interesting neighbor with the twin brother, the sort of crazy,
yes. the redheaded,
unhealthy neighbor?
The redheaded neighbor girl upstairs. I honestly think that she might have been my favorite because she's a great example of this type of writing that everyone felt genuine. Jessica felt like a genuinely bad person, like the kind of bad person that you would run into in your life. And Jerry Hogarth was a cruel and spiteful and heartless person, the way that you would kind of expect to meet that sort of person, but still professional and functional.
Trish Walker's mom.
Trish Walker's mom, abusive, the way that moms are actually abusive. And the upstairs neighbor was a genuinely unsettling character who you could tell there was something off about her, that she was insane in the way that people that have mental illness actually are. But she still had a strong personality, relationships with other characters, you know, defined goals and relationships with things. And it was...
I really thought the nice resolution of her story with, in terms of the death of her brother, that her and Malcolm had towards the end. Again, it was nice to have that scene, resolution to those two side characters. These are not characters that are impacting the superhero plot of the story, but they have some nice moments individually, then they have this nice moment together. I think that was an episode either 12 or 13. I thought that was, again, just a nice moment for these side characters, because I think they were very well developed.
This show, you know, people have talked about that it's not really a superhero show, and
sure,
the show goes really far out of its way to prove not a superhero show. The only costume that Jessica is in at any point is a hoagie. So, it's very obviously a sort of noir, crime drama, detective, like, hard-boiled PI sort of story. But really what it is like a character study. Pretty much all of the conflicts come from relationships, as opposed to plot things. I mean, let's talk about the villain, the entire motivating force of his villainy is... he got dumped by a girl and he wants her back. He also has mind controlling powers and is a absolute sociopath. But his actual goal is a very small thing that he wants
very
to...
very contained, very
he wants
focused.
To own and control one human being.
Right.
And he can't.
And there are little conveniences that he gets along the way from his powers. He likes to have a very, you know, nice life. Right, he gets things for free, and people, everyone does what he wants. Is this one overarching, driving need, and it's kind of small in the grand scheme of superhero comic bookery. And I like that. Classically, you know, the Purple Man with his mind control powers, his powers did not achieve their full resolution.
You'll say full super villainy as opposed to mere villainy.
Until Dr. Doom took his powers and became Emperor Doom, because he could control all 7 billion people on the planet, which he found kind of boring.
Out of curiosity, is there anyone's power that Doom has not stolen at one point or another?
You know, I think the Silver Surfer, to be fair, lent his cosmic powers.
Well, if you say you get them back, it makes it lending. Then he's never stolen anything.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I think the failure of the Fantastic Four movie means that we're probably never going to get Mike Coulter demanding his $200 from Doom. Where's my money, honey? We're never going to happen.
That is a tragedy.
That's a disappointment. Hopefully he'll say that to somebody along the way. Maybe.
Somebody. Anyone.
Maybe the Kingpin.
I would be okay with this.
I wouldn't mind that crossover.
Matt stole him from Peter. Luke can steal him from Matt. Speaking of, there's some, you know, we already mentioned Claire Temple, the eternally done with everything nurse. There's a little bit of tying into the greater universe, less so than Daredevil. And I think that really helps this feel like, as you were saying, a small story. It feels kind of very claustrophobic. Even just her hallways, her apartment, the way it's shot, everything feels very closed in and paranoid, which is a really, really cool feeling. It goes along with that very sort of psychological bend and focus that the series has.
And if you remember, towards the end of Daredevil, one of my moderately sized complaints, my biggest complaint, though it wasn't all that big, was that the scale of the fight in the last couple of episodes was such that I thought maybe it would get someone else's attention. An Avengers attention or something like mm-hmm. that. That was...
S.H.I.E.L.D. would have taken some notice.
That was not out of the question. But here, everything, again, is so very small. You know, it never really gets beyond, you know, one police precinct.
Right.
In terms of, you know, who was impacted. So I like that. Again, it had this small scale, but this powerful scale. And it was mm-hmm. telling, as you said, a powerful emotional story. And I think here in the 21st century, we think about words like controlling, words like dominating, creeping, as being much more serious than we may have taken them a generation or two back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that the very nature of the Purple Man's powers is kind of disturbing to us today, and then said, you know, 60s X-Men.
Charles Xavier
was wiping minds and controlling people like left, right, and center. That's how the X-Men stayed out of public eye for so long, was because
it was just what his power was. It wasn't that big a deal. But we've just, you know, taken a different view, just where we are right now. And in 25 years, things we think are awesome now, people will look back and be podcasting.
And we will say the word problematic.
2016, what were they thinking about? No! You know, I mean, these
the
things change.
History.
Exactly. But I thought that was done very well. And obviously, you know, they did get very specific in terms of Jessica, you know, calling him a rapist and those sorts of things. Now, they really did get down to brass tacks. But even on the smaller scale, the smaller controls, the smaller things that he was exercising.
And it's something that many people have talked about, but his calling card being Smile. And one of the women at the support group for the victims of Kilgrave saying, he just wouldn't let me stop smiling for like 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that smaller level creepiness of guys that you do not know coming up to you on the street and demanding you smile as though not smiling is some sort of insult to the world.
Right.
No, I don't feel very happy. You don't get to see that smile. Right. I have no reason to be doing so. Taking the concept of the Purple Man and tying it very much into that toxic, controlling, mm-hmm. creepy, sexual, mm-hmm. entitled concept. Mm-hmm. And looking at that was an interesting place to take it. And because this is a feminist show and gender equality is important, his counterpoint is a female, Jerry Hogarth, who is so much like him, it is insane.
I think what makes Kilgrave and the David Tennant performance of him so strong is that it's a power we can identify with. We know or know of people who've been victimized by the non-superpowered version
exactly.
of the controlling mind-messing, mind-effing, mind-games person. And you add a little bit of a superpower to that, and that takes it to the next level. But what we also see, as you pointed out, is the human version of that.
Mm-hmm.
The how bad this situation is, this power is, this impulse is, even not heightened.
Exactly. And so Jerry really is the callousness mm-hmm. of Kilgrave, and that she is repeatedly called heartless by her ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that she is. That's what makes her such a good lawyer, is that she mm-hmm. she just shuts her emotions out. You see her failed relationship with her wife and the failing relationship right. with her secretary, that both of those fall apart because she is unable to recognize her flaws, admit that she has screwed up
mm-hmm.
these same flaws that Kilgrave has, where Jessica will ask him, don't you understand? I don't care about you because you already messed this up.
Right.
This is never going to fix itself. You need to apologize because what you did was wrong. And he says no.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the exact same thing that Jerry's wife asks for. Just admit that you screwed me on this and I will stop, you know, blackmailing you. admit that you messed up. Admit that you were the one who ruined our marriage. And Jerry says, no, I didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. Then you get the need to own another person's body.
Right.
In mm-hmm. this case with Trish's mother.
Right.
That Trish's mom's need to control her daughter's appearance, her weight, her job, her friends, all of her life choices. And then Jessica, of course, pops in and says, that's not acceptable.
Not going to happen, yeah.
Not acceptable at all.
But again, that is what the negative stereotype of the stage parent or the sports parent, mm-hmm. whatever area that is. Again, it's exercising a type of control over another human. And when it's outside of the realm of superpowers, we mm-hmm. don't like it. When you add that layer on top of it, it's compelling stuff.
Repulsive.
Yes.
Repulsive and compelling. That is, I think, the best way to describe Kilgrave and these two variants characters. And since we're talking specifically about women, and I made my mm-hmm. feminism point earlier, I think that Jessica Jones is a great sort of hallmark for feminism, because pretty much everyone is a terrible person.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of your gender, your race, your career, you're pretty much a terrible person.
Except Trish.
There's about four exceptions. Trish, Malcolm, and the secretary, who's just in a bad position.
Luke Cage is pretty awesome.
Luke Cage is a pretty cool dude. But he's got his own problems that he's working through.
Yes.
And that was a thing that I really appreciated, that you do have these two terrible, terrible women. But at no point are you thinking, man, the reason that this person is so terrible is in some way tied to her femininity.
Exactly.
It's because they're just repulsive people.
Right.
So I thought that was great. Additionally, as I've mentioned frequently, Jerry and her wife,
mm-hmm.
a lesbian character, in a lot of senses, the stereotype, the predatory lesbian,
mm-hmm.
who is unable to keep any sort of steady, healthy relationship. But you don't feel like that's a result of her sexuality. It's because she's a terrible human being.
Right, right.
And a very good lawyer.
And I think there's a boldness there in taking, you know, a minority type of character and saying, we're not going to put him up on a pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to say, because they are different from us, that makes them better. Whether it's sort of the magical Native American stereotype or the magical black man stereotype that you see sometimes. It's not, in this case, the perfect LGBT character.
Yeah, it's not. It's okay. You can just say it. It's not Neil Patrick Harris, who is a magical being. I don't know how a person is that perfect, but.
So I like that. I like that they gave her, you know, she's a real person. You know, she's not heroic or a role model because of her identity. Mm-hmm. And like you said, really none of the women fall into that category.
Yeah,
I think that's a strength.
The closest example you have to that is Trish.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just because she's a really good person.
Yeah.
And she's not infallible, and she has stumbling moments, and she makes poor romantic life decisions. But understandable ones, which then, of course, mm-hmm. blow up in her face. Because unfortunately, I'm pretty sure it's a rule, if you are the best friend, sister, neighbor, friend of a superhero, you must date a supervillain at least once. It seems to be a recurring theme.
What did you think of Luke Cage? And are you looking forward to a solo show as much as I am?
One, I love Luke Cage. Two, I need Luke Cage. I loved him and the motorcycle he rode it on. That thing was glorious.
I like the motorcycle helmets that they had.
Cool
they
look.
Were like old fashioned. They looked like World War II infantry helmets. Is the model that they look like.
And we got the best shot ever, where Luke and Jess were doing some staking out on the motorcycle, and they get off the motorcycle and they sort of crouch down next to each other, and she's, you know, whatever, 8 inches shorter than him, so she sort of fits right in his, like, underarm, right next to his pectoral, and his head's right up there, and they're both wearing giant sunglasses and the motorcycle helmets, and it's the cutest thing. I ship it. Not yet. He's got some issues to work through, but
now, one thing I did not like about the show,
mm-hmm.
one plot area, and it's a comic book thing where everything has to be connected to everything else, was that we have Luke's tragic backstory with his wife, and we have Jessica's tragic backstory of being controlled by Kilgrave, and they have to intersect. I thought that was just too comic book convenient for a show that was not doing comic book trope stereotype stuff.
I disagree. The one example I had of that same complaint was actually the accident that gave Jess her powers being tied to Nuke. I didn't like that one. That was the same evil scientific three-letter acronym group.
Not AIM.
Not AIM.
Not AIM.
Diet AIM. Much like Diet Steve Rogers. Never accept diet.
Now, did you like Nuke? Did you like the super soldier pills being part of the powers in terms of how they were manifested?
I didn't mind it because, especially with the cinematic universe, Steve Rogers is sort of patient zero.
True.
That they even made mention in Incredible Hulk. Mm-hmm. I think it was Incredible Hulk. Maybe Hulk. I don't know. One of the Hulks that Bruce Banner was using the gamma radiation in conjunction with some of that Captain America blood in order to try and recreate the super soldier serum. Tony Stark's father working, you know, with Captain America and, I'm going to say, more importantly, Agent Peggy Carter. We'll get to that. His backstory is actually linked back to Cap. Like, sort of everyone's tied to Cap. Everyone's trying to unlock the super soldier serum. So I did not mind that. Mm-hmm. It was a little odd, but I did like the story. Right. And especially I liked with him being introduced first as a victim, then as a romantic interest, then as a support sidekick, and then a villain. Like, that was an interesting trajectory.
I wasn't sure what I thought at first about when he took the pills, he was as powerful, more powerful than Jess. And I was trying to figure out the power levels and where I wanted them all to line up. I liked the fact that no one was overly powered. Mm-hmm. I mean, the plot was Kilgrave attempting to become overpowered. They were very clear about the limits of his ability, both in time and distance. And I thought that was that was a reasonable plot.
And they did drop one line reference that when Simpson is actually fighting Jessica, he says, normal, like, you would be able to kick my butt, but you were just hit by a semi-truck.
Right, that's true.
So that's sort of...
Right.
Sort of
so, her, so she was weakened at that moment, that's
with,
true.
Her with a broken rib and a minor concussion.
Versus him on the stuff.
Him on the diet Captain America pills, he was a little bit more powerful than her if she was injured. She still took him down. Okay, there's a certain amount of finality that you can have of slamming a guy's head repeatedly into a fridge.
Yeah.
And then there's another level of finality, which is just knocking the fridge over onto him. Yeah.
I did like, towards the end, when she had the fight with Luke, when he was being controlled.
Oh, that was a great
about
fight.
About walls that were crushed falling down.
Hiding behind walls, and then arms just come through like the Kool-Aid Man.
And then Luke jumping through the wall that he had made, jumping through the wall, and... I thought that was very clever.
Jess
use of...
using Luke's head to break a brick wall.
So overall, I thought it was I thought it was solid because I thought the story was solid. Mm-hmm. I thought that underlying story was solid. Obviously, as we said, I think there are things that, in terms of the presentation, you know, that is going to make it not for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, based on personal tastes and preferences and what you are comfortable seeing and not seeing, both in terms of sort of traditional content things, but then also, you know, the psychological stuff, the creeped out factor as well. So sort of, there are many, I think, reasonable reasons why someone might jump off.
There's a lot of shows that give content warnings. This is one that actually does deserve a trigger warning because there's some intensive PTSD stuff that's going on in there. And it's good. It's really good. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to watch. Yeah. But I think that Jessica Jones was a show where the writing was the standout. Right. That every character, every scene, every episode was expertly written. Some of the plot elements and the grand structural things could have done with some tweaking.
And I liked that she was a very tiny, not muscular person.
So small. So thin.
What she has is extra heightened. I don't need Superman to be super muscular, actually. So I kind of like that it was a fairly fragile-looking, frail little person who could leap, maybe leap not tall, a tall building, but leap a medium-sized building. Leap a building.
You know, leap your standard, you know, midtown Manhattan short rise.
Has Jessica Jones been confirmed for a season two that you know of?
I believe that they have said yes, tentatively, but, like, they haven't confirmed the cast or, you know, any of that stuff.
It has to do with scheduling and when it,
Yeah, so all of the scheduling stuff about when they're actually going to get a date on it hasn't happened.
In terms of Netflix, Daredevil season two is coming out in late March. And then is Luke Cage next?
Is sometime, I saw a rough estimate, sometime like October-ish. Late summer, early fall. Okay.
Seems that as these shows become sort of hits
independently
and get new seasons, that just pushes the Defenders back further and further. Is that is your interpretation the same as mine?
I just really want there to not be a Punisher Netflix series.
Oh, that's
one.
It pushes it back too much further.
One, it pushes everything back 6 months. Two, he has not even shown up on Daredevil yet. Sit down, guys. You got two movies. I want my Iron Fist TV show. But that does give a very important question, which I asked you yesterday.
When is the Moon Knight series starting?
Asked that question. When Luke and Danny invariably team up,
yes.
Of course, there will be the motorcycle. And if there's a duo, you know, you can ride on the motorcycle and it's cool. But when forced to choose, bro or ho, who's going to get that second seat on the motorcycle? Who is going to end up in a sidecar?
Oh, see, I've got a feeling Danny's going to end up in the sidecar. Have a feeling.
I don't know. What I secretly just really want is for the Defenders to not be able to afford a, you know, flying bathtub, obviously. But to take a certain aesthetic from the Fantasticar and just have Luke and two sidecars. You put Matt and Danny in the sidecars and Luke and Jess on the motorcycle, riding into battle.
You would need two more World War II surplus helmets, but
Matt has a helmet, he's fine.
There you go.
But just think about that mental image.
Now, as you said before, Jessica Jones hit right around the same time Supergirl hit, and much stupidity on the internet reigned.
Yeah. Because I think if you take Jessica Jones and put it through a Bizarro beam, you get Supergirl. Because there is literally nothing in common there except for the gender of the main characters. But, of course, the stupidity reigned and think pieces were written about how Jessica Jones' popularity proved that that is what female viewers want. No? No, not really. Because Supergirl is almost as big a hit.
And because homogeneic demographic groups have heterogeneity within them. That is, not everyone in the group's exactly the same.
No, it's possible for males to like both My Little Pony and or Longmire? I don't think that's possible. Maybe lady peoples like both Jessica Jones and Supergirl.
Or some like one and not the other, and some like the other and not the one. Some like neither, some like both. Whoa, mind blown!
And some 60-year-old males are very, very excited for Supergirl. I mean Bob Fisher.
Yes. Now, we talked to Bob and Michael. And a whole nice little grouping of Superman podcasters in the aftermath of the pilot of Supergirl that is available at the Superman and Batman podcast feed. We were positive about it. Everyone else was gushing.
We were
positive.
We were thused. We were not unenthused, but nor were we mind blown about it. There were solid, serious flaws, which the following six episodes pretty much completely addressed and has moved beyond.
Yeah, I think it's gotten better and better and better.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
One of the issues that I think a lot of people had, me a little less, maybe some a little more, was Cat Grant in the pilot. And I think she has grown tremendously as a character. As I said on that episode, pilots are their own thing. They have to deal in some broad archetypes. And I think the Supergirl pilot did that.
For the network pitch, you kind of have to play to stereotypes.
Exactly.
That doesn't necessarily mean that's the way you're going to play the rest of the series.
And I think they were exactly right, either in that was their plan, or that in some of the feedback from the pilot, they toned down some of Cat Grant's craziness.
Shrillness. You can say screeching. The word harpy might apply a little bit to the pilot.
But gave her some character traits. The episode with the mother.
Yes.
Really opened up a lot about her and
understanding some
let
of her,
us in.
Some
yes.
of her emotional reservedness. Mm-hmm. Coming from a difficult childhood. We got to see her and her adorable little son,
yes.
who, of course, my immediate thought was, huh, I wonder if him and baby Bruce hang in the same circles. His mom's rich enough. I wonder if those two have ever met at a Wayne charity function.
Exactly. So how do we like this show halfway through the season?
It's pretty great. Now by episode like 10 or 11, it's really become the Supergirl show that I hoped it would be after the pilot.
Yeah.
It was the show that was being hinted at, and I just mm-hmm. really hoped it was going to follow that trail.
I'm glad they reduced the direct and indirect Superman mentions and appearances, that he's moved into the background a little bit. You know, he's obviously still a presence in the world and in her life.
And something that I appreciate is there have been more Clark Kent references.
True, yes.
Because they are a media corporation. Kat used to work at the Planet. Kat hates Lois Lane. I don't think there is a running gag that I think is funnier than her deep-seated loathing for Lois Lane. Especially now that Lucy is working for her.
Yes.
It was a great episode involving Kat's leaked emails of, okay, look for anything embarrassing. Well, she funded Jekyll and Hyde the musical. She once spent a whole stupid bunch of money investing in a defunct television show. Got snubbed at the Oscars by Leonardo DiCaprio. And there are 317 emails in which she refers to Lois Lane as A, and then it immediately cuts to Grant. Oh, please. I call her worse to her face all the time.
Yeah, I do like that the actress who plays Lucy Lane looks to me the way Lois Lane should look.
Yeah.
So I like that. I mean, I can see her as Lois's sister.
You can infer some
exactly.
Lois from
exactly.
her. And most importantly, her dad is a D-bag. Yeah, because General Sam Lane shows up.
But
This will make things better. I think that was Michael Bailey's snotty reply. Oh, great. Sam Lane's here. Everything's uphill from this point on. I think that my biggest issues with the pilot, mm-hmm. which I am the happiest they have addressed, mm-hmm. were the bosses. I did not like either of Kara's bosses.
Right. Right.
Because
Kat or Hank.
Hank Henshaw, at least to me, very much in the pilot, was just stern, gruff, aggressive, dismissive, low-key sexist boss.
Right.
And I was like, we're in 2015. We can't get past this. We can't write a male boss who's supervising, who's not a total D-bag. And it felt like, especially in the pilot, that he had lots of low-key sexist moments, specifically so the girls could show off how awesome and feminist they were.
Right.
And that was kind of annoying and condescending. That has fortunately gone away.
Right.
Not only is Hank straight up not sexist because he's, spoilers, not actually Hank Henshaw, but the Danvers girls have mm-hmm. not quite sure how to say it, but have been less 90s in their feminist leanings, that it's less look at me, I'm so awesome, girl power raw, and more just, no, these are two competent women. Look at them sitting there and being competent. See how competent they are? Competency.
Exactly.
And of course, Cat Grant, who we said is phenomenal now. I love her so much in her cattiness. She is the perfect Devil Wears Prada, but heart of gold. Teeny tiny Grinch heart, but still, there's a heart of gold in there somewhere.
Now, as we were watching the show, you, me, and your mom, she was the first one of us three to verbalize, is he John Johns?
Yes, that was the best, is that, first of all, she saw his glowy red eyes, and I think she texted me something about, oh, it's him with the glowy eyes, and I was like, okay. And then I came home 2 or 3 days later, she was like, Jean, right? Your alien son. I was like, thanks, Mom. Yes, I do love Jean Jones. I love him a lot. I'm not quite sure that is Martian Manhunter. She's like, no, I'm pretty sure it is.
Well, to be fair, she did not know who Cyborg Superman was, or Hank Henshaw, or she had no other baggage other than the baggage of knowing that you love Martian Manhunter.
The only thing that she was bringing to it was the great Justice League Unlimited episode, Comfort and Joy.
The Christmas episode, of course. I loved where Martian Manhunter, they were talking about, he was revealing his powers and how he's not able to read the minds of Kryptonians. Your cousin thinks that's hilarious. So I love the fact that they know each other, which means...
Christmas with the Kents!
It, in my head canon,
it's a thing.
That animated episode has happened.
Next year? Christmas with the Danverses? Maybe?
See? Now, I want to say, as much as we could pat my wife on the back for getting that, once that was a little more in the ether... I said out loud that I think he is the alien that they went down to.
Yeah, that Hank Henshaw and Agent Danvers went to go check on. And because there was this whole thing about Hank Henshaw and Dr. Danvers went down into South America and only Hank came back. And I was like, I'm pretty sure Hank Henshaw did not come back from South America.
Exactly. So I love that. Gem, son of Saturn, are you kidding me?
that's a deep pull. What they're doing.
That is a deep pull.
Also, played by Charles Halford, a.k.a. Francis Chaz Chandler from Constantine. There is my token reference for this episode.
So I'm enjoying where this show is going, and fingers crossed, continue onward and upward. I'm not in love with all the Kryptonians that they're fighting. I would rather there to be some other antagonists than just going the go-to antagonist being Kryptonians. I don't know specifically what I'm wanting to see there, but I like her team. I like the support characters. What do you think of actual Jimmy Olsen, and what do you think of Win, the proto Jimmy Olsen?
The thing about this show is that even though it doesn't have Superman, it has a pretty great Superman analog, actually, in Hank Henshaw slash Jean Jones. He's actually a pretty good Superman, which is funny if you go back to their original publications. Mm-hmm. We may have a character named James Olsen, but Win is actually a pretty good Jimmy Olsen as far as generally running about, being sort of helpful and kind of annoying me. Pretty sure he's even worn a bow tie at one point, and I was like, ah, yes, the circle is complete. With Jimmy Olsen technically kind of being our Brainiac 5, our older, bald love interest for Supergirl.
Now, in terms of those other characters, we've gotten Maxwell Lord.
Ugh! I love him! He's got such a stupid, punchable face! It's amazing!
So what you're saying is, we know that the DC movies and the DC TV shows don't cross over. But if just for, 8 seconds, Gal Gadot could show up, kill him on live TV and leave, that would be okay
just
with you?
Run through and just like hold her arm out, just like crunch, and I'm off. See ya.
That could work for you?
I'm just saying, he's a pretty good Lex Luthor as far as this series is going. Like,
yeah.
I'm kind of digging it. Speaking of blondes with superpowers who eat brains, I mean...
Wait.
What?
No, that's only...
That would only be Liv Moore.
From iZombie.
Which continues to be a shockingly, almost undeservedly, good show.
I agree.
I have no idea how this thing exists, or how it is as good as it is.
Last season wrap-up, I said, maybe iZombie's the show, if there's a break, maybe I'll dip in every now and then. No, I've watched every episode.
iZombie and Supergirl together have definitely bumped to just about the top of my weekly viewing list and have absolutely decimated Gotham. It has been left in the dust.
Yeah, for me it's so many for me ago. It's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but same
thing.
Sleepy Hollow, same. It's just there's not enough room on the DVR.
There's not enough hours in the day.
Not enough hours watching in the day, so those ones had to go.
We have no time.
iZombie has risen up the charts.
We have no time for mediocre comic book adaptations.
Not anymore. There was a time. There was a time, but that time has passed. There's enough that we don't have to feel obligated. We can watch the ones we want to watch.
And I think Gotham is getting good enough ratings that as long as it's going, I will be picking it up during the season breaks on Netflix.
Exactly.
iZombie is just so funny. So freaking funny. And yet, still heart-wrenching and totally motivating. Like, you totally feel for these characters, even though they are so ridiculous. And the white bread, milk toast, lunkhead, ex-boyfriend / roommate is named Major Lillywhite. He's literally Captain Awesome from Chuck, except that his first name is Major.
Yeah. Well, her name is Liv Moore. Subtlety is not really what the creators were going for.
And the doctor's name is Ravi Chakrabarty. Really what? Likes Arsenal.
Exactly. Very good taste in English football teams for him to support. What I like about this show is there are plenty of blanks of the week, case of the week, freak of the week, monster of the week shows. What I like about this one is it's a double act. It's the case of the week, and it's the personality trait of the week for Liv based on the brain that she eats. And in terms of the zombie part of the show, every episode has about a 10-second montage.
15-second-ish montage of her.
Of her chopping up a brain, cooking it, microwaving it, sauteing it, and eating it, whatever.
Has gotten increasingly funny in this season because you and I are both Food Network people. And she's gotten inventive. There's some sautéed brains with risotto, and there's some meat brain balls with a hot sauce-based marinara. And
she could be on Chopped in a few years. She's getting there. So, other than that, it's not really a zombie show in terms of, I think, creepy and sort of Walking Dead level of gore and that sort of thing.
No, though... This show also has something in its subplot that I think you hear very infrequently. Zombie corporate espionage.
True.
Which gives us some interesting stuff. And those scenes are pretty messed up. But as with most great zombie shows, TV shows, whatever, it's the humans dealing with the zombies
that are the horrifying, monstrous
characters. And
it does hit some of those big picture tropes. But it really is definitely telling its own unique crime procedural with a
sort of
zombie character.
Camp, but still sort of just serious enough for you to feel when things go terrible for the characters, you do feel for it.
Yeah.
It is like just on that side of serious.
Right, and it has enough of these of the weak elements that it's, I think it tilts mostly towards a procedural with these long going both character arcs and a couple of subplots in terms of where the zombie outbreak came from and how can we stop it, or
the zombie cure, the best zombie hunter in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And his sad, sad, tragic fall into everything. Oh, God.
So you've got a couple sort of ongoing subplots, but mostly it is what's the case and what is the personality that Liv is going to embody.
What aspects of this person is Liv going to have to deal with? One week she might be a rich socialite.
That was a good one.
One, she might be a country singer, which was amazing.
That was a great one. It reminded me a little bit of that one episode of Leverage. Hello, Michael Bailey.
Yep. There was some studio job moments. And it gave us Dr. Ravi in a 10-gallon Stetson and like a button-up Western shirt and bolo tie, which is the funniest thing. Like, if you have never seen a 6'2" bearded British Indian doctor attempting to blend into a country bar, it is hysterical.
He does refer to himself as tall, dark, and handsome on occasion, so...
And I've got a British accent. What's not to love?
And, I don't know if I mentioned this, great taste in English football clubs to support. So he's a win-win.
Which even played a role in one of the plots.
That was my favorite.
That's the thing that continues to impress me, because you say it's an of-the-week show, and it's, you know, case drama, procedural. And you sort of expect it to be really formulaic. And it is. But it's pulled off in a really good way, that the actual
mysteries are
pretty well constructed, that about 30% of the time I can guess the ending.
Right.
But I mean, you watch an episode of House.
And you can
know how it's going to end.
Right.
But they do a good job of introducing enough suspects and witnesses and questioning enough people. And the twists don't tend to feel contrived.
Okay, right.
They do a good job of mixing it up. Like, one episode, the motivation was revenge. The next one, it was a mistaken identity and they killed the wrong person. That's why there wasn't a motive. Or it was an accident, or it was because of drugs, or they were forced to do it, or it was blackmail, or that person had a split personality, or whatever.
And the mechanisms by which they solve the cases are a combination of the flashes that she gets.
And really solid police work.
From solid police work and Ravi's, you know, work in the crime lab.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of those working together. Their police contact, Babineau, is a really skilled, good questioner and observant policeman. And, you know, she has these, psychic visions?
Yes.
That help, and he does the lab work that helps. It's a nice team. The skills to solve the crimes is equally distributed among them. It's not the two of them leading the sort of clueless
the bumbling
police detective. That's not the case.
Or even Ravi being secondary. Like,
right.
He's actually, you know, pretty well involved, that he is a very competent medical examiner. You're never quite sure if the final piece of evidence that's going to solve it is going to be Babineau followed up on the phone records and found out, oh, hey, they actually called this person at this time. Or if it's going to be a star witness who comes out and just confesses. Or if it's going to be Ravi. Or sometimes even Major. Or Peyton.
Oh, right. Yeah,
Peyton
one of the
works
real
in the DA.
Right.
You never know quite who's going to come with that final piece of evidence, that it could be sort of anyone. And that helps. That helps keep things fresh. The personalities help keep things fresh because every single week, Liv's doing something crazy and trying to have to find ways to explain it to the people around her without just saying, I'm a zombie. Sorry, guys. Also, zombies are real. Run away. I liked this season, Blaine, the main villain of last season.
Right.
At the season finale, he was cured of his zombism. And in this season, he's still around as a major antagonist and is actually pretending to be a zombie so that he can keep his brain racket going. But he's now working as a fine upstanding member of the moratorium community. He's a funeral director. But he's still he's so creepy and he's so obsessed with death. And he's still such an interesting, skeevy character. even though you've taken the one thing that sort of made him unique and taken that away, still the same guy, still trying the same plans, still rampantly killing people, just for slightly different reasons.
Strong cast, strong writing. Again, I don't know why we keep saying surprisingly or shockingly
we
good show,
stop
but
being surprised
at some point we just say it's a pretty good show.
I think the problem is that you never really get past fake zombie, scientist, police, detective, zombie crime procedural. Like
on the CW.
On the CW. Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot that you... There are a lot of expectations that
might be
brought to that.
I love that everyone in... Like, the entire cast is stupid attractive because of the CW.
Yeah.
But people in the show mention how weird it is that all these people are that attractive. That is amazing. That is a level of self-awareness that the CW I didn't think was capable of.
Yeah.
Didn't you say there was one episode where they were on the set of the in-universe Zombie High?
Yes. That was funny.
Zombie High, which was literally Vampire Diaries.
Exactly.
And it was CW making fun of itself on the CW.
Yes.
That's brilliant.
That's good. That's good.
I think
good.
My personal favorite episode was the magic episode.
Ah, right, right.
Where she had eaten the brains of a goth stage magician who was in touch with the forces and all that stuff. And so she was trying to figure out which one of the magicians hated him. Pretty much everyone did.
Yeah.
Because they thought that he was an embarrassment. They're like, no, we all know this isn't real. That's the whole point. We're illusionists. The way it worked out was when the first time I saw their Penn and Teller
analog right.
on the show, it was Smoke and Mirrors. Again, a great
yeah, that's pretty
good. Pun name. I saw Mr. Mirrors, and I said, that's a woman in drag. And then they showed closer shots, and I was like, oh, wait, oh, no, I was mistaken. It's just a weird haircut. Okay, all right, cool. Just a small, slight dude. And, like Teller, was a mute character. It's revealed in the end that, indeed, Mears was a woman. It's why she never spoke in character. And she was actually the murderer. She'd been posing as the maid. Mears was all about illusions. That was so great to me, of murderer, witness, and an unrelated suspect. All the same person.
Right. And so... A lot of the times they are able to tie in the solving of the crime to whatever subculture or group or area that the crime has taken place in. That side of it, the crime-solving side of it, I think is surprisingly strong.
Yeah.
That is not what the CW specializes in. That's
no.
what CBS specializes in. That's what other networks specialize in, the police procedural. Those are the three main shows currently on the air, or just off the air in Jessica Jones's case. Though I guess it's still always available on Netflix. So you know what I mean. In terms of lead characters, sort of named title characters. Did want to mention, as of this recording, it has started, but we're not talking in details about it. But Agent Carter is back.
Yes!
I love the concept of the move to Los Angeles. I want them to go to London next season.
Yes.
And
yes.
set up that branch.
Post,
I do want to see the post-Blitz
London.
I really want to see that rebuilding. The building of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the rebuilding of London. There's a lot of potential there. But I'm looking forward to this Los Angeles season as well. And I agree with Paul Spataro. I've heard him recently speak. I try not to use that sentence very often, but I share his views on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is, I used to think it was a pretty good show until they replaced it in the same time slot every year with a much better show called Agent Carter.
And then it comes back to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And then it comes back to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. That's a disappointment. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is one of the ones that I've jumped off of somewhat this year. I think I've watched all the episodes, but... It takes a while. They hang out on the DVR for a while. I do like what they did with Simmons, that she got sucked into an alternate dimension.
Yes.
That was a nice survival story. And so and that's part of my problem with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that they have so many characters. There are a couple storylines and characters that I like, but I don't need to see more S.H.I.E.L.D. versus Hydra. I mean, I've seen that story many, many times. Let's move on. Andy Leyland mentioned, why can't they just do Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as the A-Team?
Yeah.
They solve a problem every week and move on. Let's do that.
Guys, this was season one, and I was the only person who loved it. Got your overarching spy drama, and you're like,
You're right.
If only they could just go back to being a team who, when you need them, if you can find them, they'll go stop some supervillains. Just saying.
I know.
Guys didn't appreciate it while you had it.
You are among your generation. You are one of the millennials who does not need everything to be an arc.
No. I am a person who lives entirely in the time-shifted new paradigm.
That's true.
I do not watch anything week to week. The only thing I watch week to week is Supergirl.
Mm-hmm.
Because every Tuesday at 8 p.m., it becomes available on CBS.com.
I was going to say. Because every Monday at 8 p.m., Mike Bailey starts tweeting about it.
His live tweet, yes, indeed. Which reminds me, I've got to make sure that my schedule's clear tomorrow so I can watch this thing.
See?
But I don't watch anything as it comes out. I don't watch anything weekly. I might skip 3 or 4 weeks of a show that I am closely following.
Right.
Like,
and then
iZombie, I'm currently one episode behind on. I'm 2 episodes behind on Supergirl because it's just come back out.
Right. But, for example, on Supergirl, in 2 weeks, you'll watch all 4 of them.
Exactly. So I watch everything in a marathon.
Right.
I'm just like, I'm going to sit down and watch this show for as much free time as I have, which could be an episode and a half, 3.5, or 5.
Right.
I actually quite like that freedom, as opposed to if I wait 5 weeks, I'm going to have to sit down and watch 5 weeks all at once because it's all one story. If I can come in and out of the story, it's actually better.
Now, I do like the mini-series approach that Agent Carter does.
So good.
8 episodes, I think it's going to be. The X-Files is coming back with 6. And I love that concept. I love the mini-series TV concept because 22 hours of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is daunting.
Too much.
Just too much is daunting.
And frankly, they don't have enough plot to cover it. They have about 16 hours of plot.
There is that. That may be part of what makes Agent Carter work so well, is that it's in essence the British TV model, where you're writing to a very limited number of episodes per season, per series.
Actually, even Supergirl did that at one point. There was about 3 or 4 episodes where each episode led directly into the following one. But then after those 4 episodes, standalone episode, standalone episode, two-parter, standalone
that
episode,
works.
Standalone.
I like that model.
I think that that's really the model TV needs to go towards, is a couple of episodes where they're doing their standalone of the week, and then a small series where they can tell a slightly larger story.
But a complete one. But not the serialized soap opera, never-ending Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. mentioned it being a 22-episode. I guess now we're in the third season, so it's done about 60 episodes. And at that point, you're telling just this ongoing story that, like a comic book series, can feel decompressed and stretched out. So the idea of having an end date, having this many episodes to tell a story, then we're going to go away for a while, is really attractive to me. I think Netflix has figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
How to make that work. I think Agent Carter's figured out how to make that work. I hope the X-Files has figured out how to make that work as well. So summing up for Agent Carter, it is high hopes for Los Angeles, high hopes for season 2, and then at the end of season TV wrap-up, we'll actually talk about the show.
Hopefully it was awesome.
And then as we do with our TV talk type of episodes, we will end with the CW Flash and Arrowverse shows.
Meanwhile, in the past.
This may be, we're proposing here, maybe next year's big crossover. And one of the first things we had to think about was who's the victim. But This was the part that I came up with. I'm pretty pleased with. Because we don't want Felicity dead. She's crippled.
Paralyzed. And, from the waist down.
And ends up in the wheelchair.
As Oracle.
We lead into
Birds of Prey. So I'm not saying that we called it, but we called it. Not only does it look like we are quite probably going to get Oracle in this next season of Arrow, but we've got two canaries, both of them on active teams. Mm-hmm. We've had the Hawks introduced, and Hawk Girl was a major focus of this end of first half of Flash season two. Whatever.
Vixen is coming.
We had the Vixen CW Seed show. I just want to point out, that was a pretty good little show. Animated nicely, had that sort of DC animated look. It was really weird, because Barry and Oliver were both voiced by the same actors, but they tried to do a like a face merge of themselves and their DCU, like what the Flash in the DC anime looked like, but merged with Grant Gustin. And same thing with, it was not good. It was really, really unfortunate. Well, Cisco looked pretty good, though.
Well, fortunately, we're going to be getting Vixen IRL.
There has been Huntress in the past. I'm just saying, a Birds of Prey-esque thing might be coming down the line.
I like the idea of what ABC is doing with Agent Carter, where Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. takes the break. Maybe at some point around this time next year, Flash and Arrow are both on a break, and we get the Birds of Prey miniseries.
And I recognize that that's not very likely, especially now that they have three interconnected TV shows, that if you're not on one show, you're probably on one of the other two. But
Conceptually,
it's a cool idea. And because of that, Vixen, it was only 10 minute episodes. Mm-hmm. It was actually pretty good. I think it might have even been shorter, like 8. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not long. But it was pretty good. Like I said, decently animated. I actually wouldn't mind that. Doing like a Birds of Prey little mini movie, sort of like the DC Showcase Present animated shorts that they did. Mm-hmm. They were like a 20 minute short. I would actually be pretty okay with that.
Right.
Of basically doing a girls' night out and say, you know, Arrow and Flash are doing a team off and the girls are like, well, you know what? We're just going to go for drinks. We're going to, you know, Felicity, you've been in this cave too long. We're going to wheel you out. We're going to go have a night on the town, and then they get accosted by ninjas. As you do.
And the ninjas regret their choice.
Immediately. Actually, speaking of animated things, I was trying to think of anything else that we were missing. This isn't TV specifically related, but I just wanted to do a quick shout out to the newest DC animated movie. But it was a Bat Family movie. So it had Batwoman and Batgirl and all sorts of, so it was basically the entire extended Robins and Batman all doing like some Bat Family related thing. The only reason I wanted to point it out is because at one point, Batwoman, Kate, and Batman have teamed up, and they are accosted by nuns with nunchucks. Yes. And Batwoman gives the straight line of, oh, nuns with assault rifles? What is the world coming to? And Bruce looks at her and goes, please, Kate, they're nunjas.
Okay, back to the episode, though. It's not that we wanted Felicity injured.
No, but I've just been saying she would make a great Oracle for quite a while.
And someone did point out in the last couple of episodes towards the end of the first half break that she was wheeling around in her office chair quite a bit inside the Arrow Cave.
Mm-hmm. That was one of my friends who I played him our pitch a year ago. And so he was like, man, there's no way. There's no way they would never hurt Felicity. I don't want them to hurt Felicity. And then as he thought on it, he was like, actually, that would be pretty cool. That would give her something kind of interesting happening in her character. And so from the very first episode, he was keeping me aware of those. And every couple weeks, I would get a text. So Felicity was rolling along the counter, and the way it was shot, you couldn't even see the office chair. It looked like she was in a wheelchair. She was doing this, she was doing that. She just asked for a code name. And then 2 weeks ago, I got the text I've been waiting for. So yeah, she can't use her legs anymore.
Now, to be fair, it's been a couple of weeks. The way that TV schedules and podcast editing goes, Ray Palmer may already have fixed her legs.
Yeah.
By the time the Hawkman magical nth metal did something to fix her. But
I want her to stay in the chair.
There's a chance of Oracle.
I want to stay here. They already have a chair. Evil Harrison left his chair.
That is true. They have a superpower.
They already have a super chair for her. So, Vixen, Oracle, fingers crossed, both versions of Canary in prominent roles.
Right. The Flash, Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow as well all seem to have a pretty healthy representation of the female character on them.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Now, other than the first episode of Arrow after the break, which we just talked about, how about the first half season of all those shows? What did we think of Flash and or Arrow in terms of that first half season?
They were both really good. Unfortunately, my brain has been so full of Supergirl and Jessica Jones and excitement over Agent Carter that it's kind of
squeezed some of them out a little bit.
Like, not entirely, but it's just sort of washed them out a little bit. Mm-hmm. That, no, that when makes... I've got Supergirl that's just so fun and upbeat and like light and fluffy and I love it so much and so much of my excitement is directed towards it, then I'm like, oh, right. Yeah, Flash. Yeah, I'll catch up on that. But it's sort of slipping into that first position of it's no longer watch it Wednesday night as soon as I can on CW.com. Now it's
I watch it over the weekend when I get a chance. Yeah.
Or, which is not an insult. I'm really enjoying them. I appreciated that we got more Grodd.
Right. And I like Patty.
I love Patty. Spiv is amazing. So cute, and not, so competent.
And not just her role in the recreation of Flash of Two Worlds.
No. Though
not
that
just
was,
that scene.
No, that was glorious. I'm really liking all of the Earth 2 stuff.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
I'm a little hesitant because I feel like it could go the S.H.I.E.L.D. direction and just have too many characters.
Right.
Too many speedsters, too many parallel versions of things. Mm-hmm. But I am very excited to see Deathstorm and Killer Frost.
Yes, they're coming.
So,
one issue that I had with Flash, I think more than Arrow, Flash seemed to be used as the Legends of Tomorrow training ground backdoor pilot a lot more than Arrow was. And I think when Arrow did it with some of their characters, it seemed like it was a more natural integration into the show with White Canary, for example.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the Flash versions, it seemed like those characters took over the show.
Yeah.
Hawkgirl, I think, took over the show for a while.
Yeah.
And it seemed like an entire episode trying to track down the other half of Firestorm, for example. So I don't think we got as much Flash action as I would have wanted in Flash.
Yeah.
I got more CW interconnectedness running through Flash. And that, they almost went too far for me. I will say that. Now, with Legends of Tomorrow now on its own, that shouldn't, fingers crossed, be as big of a problem. But that there was a stretch of episodes where it seemed like the only thing that was happening was developing characters for Legends of Tomorrow.
And I didn't mind it because it was that thing I was sort of talking about of standalone,
right,
episode, two-parter, standalone, two-parter. Okay, we're going to take three episodes
in a
row, and it's just going to be Legends of Tomorrow for three episodes. Done, okay, and then back to Flash. I think they were all good episodes, even if they were kind of distracting.
Right.
How was Arrow with this whole Damian Dark thing?
It was an interesting plot, and it continued to add sort of the magic side, the mystical side of the DCU, including an appearance by Matt Ryan as John Constantine.
My trash favorite, John Constantine.
Who was a little afraid of Damian Dark, actually. Constantine was there to create White Canary, to reattach her soul after she came out of the Lazarus Pit. And of course, the Lazarus Pit itself has this mystical connotation and the League of Shadows, etc. So that had been planted somewhat in the Arrow side of the CW verse. But Damian Dark really takes it to the next level. And that's what one of the things Constantine said to his old buddy Ollie. You know, this guy is serious.
Yeah.
You know, you really need to
really be
you
careful.
Really need
don't,
to
don't
really
mess
need
with
to
him.
Be careful with that. So between that and then obviously Vandal Savage coming in on the Legends of Tomorrow side, you know, I think some of those other characters from that side of the table, whether it's Madame Xanadu,
Zatanna,
Deadman, I mean, some of the ones we've talked about before.
I still just really
those
want...
Those doors are
I
open.
I just really, really want my season two... I know we are like one episode into Legends,
yes.
But I really want my season two Legends of Tomorrow Dark.
TV historians, folks who pay attention to things in TV, know that in the last 20, 25 years or so, Richard Belzer, as Detective Munch, broke some records for appearing as the same character in the most number of TV shows on various different networks. Michael Bailey is right now counting them on his fingers. He might be getting to his toes by now. And maybe Matt Ryan can give him a chance.
I just want that.
Because
I just want
Constantine fits on iZombie.
Constantine invading everyone else's show.
One episode on Legends of Tomorrow.
If he shows up on Lucifer, I will watch that episode.
Exactly.
And only that episode. There are too many good TV shows for me to watch barely adequate ones.
There is truth to that, my friend.
Sleepy Hollow. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And
Gotham. Yeah,
They all could just... The competition was too tough.
Mm-hmm.
Which means we win.
Let me put on my business professor hat here and mention that in a strictly competitive world, consumers tend to win. That will be on the final exam, kids. I do not call my students kids, by the way.
Oh, are you not going to do that until you're 55?
Yeah, that's right. I can call them kids now. Yes.
So here's to the super awesome, super well-written, super-powered ladies of television, including some surprisingly powerful, well-written, well-acted women on the CW.
Many of them, many of the shows we mentioned are on the CW, which I keep saying it's surprising. At some point, it has to stop being surprising. It's what they do.
I am glad that at some point
yes.
It's going to stop being surprising. I am glad that the CW is growing up. And I'm glad that these other shows have sort of placed the bar so high that we have got a really high bar now for female super characters on either scale. Either lighthearted, fun, fluffy
right.
family entertainment where you've got to be as good as Supergirl
mm-hmm.
or dark, gripping, psychological... terrifying, violent, but compelling on the Jessica Jones side. And
or just sheer quantity and volume
on
Flash
CW.
And Arrow and iZombie and Legends of Tomorrow. In general, the last decade has been a great time to be a television viewer. It has certainly, the last few years, been a great time to be a comic book fan watching TV. And if you're looking for strong female characters in your comic book-related TV shows... It's hard to think of a better time than now.
As you said, everyone wins. So we would love to hear from you about these great nerdy TV shows and these great female characters.
And any obvious ones that we missed?
Because I'm sure there are some.
Or at least less obvious ones that we missed? Let us know. And on the other shows, Gotham and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and on those other shows, if you're watching those, feel free to let us know what you're enjoying, or maybe not enjoying, about those shows as well. As you heard from the first part of the show, we love feedback and we respond to it all.
So you can send us those at our email, which is relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Or you can comment on the blog post where this episode is posted. That's relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can also leave a rating for us in iTunes, along with a review if your comments are more general.
Which the Sutherlands recently did. They are our most recent iTunes feedbackers.
Of course they are.
Thank you, Ruth and Darren.
Thanks for listening. And remember, we're not experts.
We're just family.